I'm David Smith, and you're listening to the Faith in Teaching podcast from the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Calvin University. In this series, we'll be talking with researchers and educators who are working to understand how Christian faith affects teaching, learning, and the way we do education. Today, I'm blessed to be talking to Kyle Hughes, who is an educator and a church historian and recent author of a book on teaching and spiritual formation. It's called Teaching for Spiritual Formation, but it's also got an intriguing subtitle. Kyle, tell us a little about yourself and then just tell us a little about your book and what it's about, what it's addressing.
Yeah, well, the intriguing subtitle, since you mentioned it, is A Patristic Approach to Christian Education in a Convulsed Age. So maybe as I unpack a bit of my journey, that subtitle will make more sense. So I think I'm in something of a bit of a unique setting professionally where I did my formal training in patristics, in the history and theology of the early church. I wrote my PhD on Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Tertullian, how they read the Bible. And yet my job is I'm an educator. I teach at a Christian high school just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And so I've been intrigued for a long time about, do these two worlds have anything to say to one another? Do the church fathers, these people who lived and wrote roughly in the time period 100 to maybe 600 or so, would they have anything to say to us that would help us as Christian educators living in the 21st century in our classrooms today? And not even just on a purely theological or philosophical level, but what about practically? How could they help us really get at our practices in the classroom? How might we engage our students differently in light of some of their ideas? And so that was the genesis of this project, and the subtitle reflects that.
So when I've shared the book with people, some people need a primer on that word in the subtitle, patristic. What are the boundaries of that? So who are we talking with here?
Yeah, well, scholars love to fight about exactly what we mean by the patristic period. It's a bit of an artificial categorization, of course. But roughly speaking, we're talking about from the year 100 or so, so the end of the New Testament period, then all the way until sometime in the 500s, usually Gregory the Great. Usually we kind of put him at the beginning of the medieval period. So most famously, if you've heard, for instance, of St. Augustine, Augustine of Hippo, maybe you've heard of folks like the Cappadocian Fathers, the Desert Fathers. Patristics, of course, is referring to the fathers, men, and it's a bit unfortunate, but the reality is, in terms of the writings that we have from that time period, we simply don't have as many writings from Christian women. As we get later into church history, we do find all kinds of very interesting female Christian writers, Julian of Norwich, Hildegard of Bingen, and so forth. But in this period, we're talking, again, roughly maybe 100 to 600.
Mm-hmm. So I rejoiced when the book came out because I love the idea of this kind of conversation. And over the years, I've led professional development with groups from K-12 teachers up to grad school engineering professors, where I've used older historical texts. I've done things with, I spent a lot of time with Comenius, who's 17th century. I've used, you know, Bernard of Clairvaux, who's 1,000 years ago. And it's always gone very well, and it's been very rich, and it's led to very rich conversations. But I've also always had this feeling like I'm doing something seriously weird, possibly even a little bit like forbidden, because it seems like these days education is positioned as a social science, right? And if you make claims about education, you're supposed to be citing research that happened in the last 5 years. And so this notion that we might want to talk to people from the second century or the third century, not just for like their Christology or something, but for actually for advice on teaching, that feels a bit transgressive in the current context. So yeah. I mean, how do you see that? What's the case for having this conversation?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And I wonder to what extent that's a uniquely Protestant conversation we might be having. I wonder if in Catholic or Orthodox contexts, maybe this kind of approach would be more normal.
Right.
And I think it's helpful in our more Protestant context to recall, for instance, that the Protestant reformers themselves very much viewed their work as going back to the church fathers. that they didn't see themselves as going back to a pure, unadulterated New Testament theology, so much as retrieving folks like St. Augustine and those people that we're talking about in this time period. And I think for those who are skeptical of if the fathers have something to tell us, I think one way to approach it is, these are the same people who gave us, for example, the doctrine of the Trinity, that as Christians we wholeheartedly embrace and hold to be central to our faith. They're the ones who gave us the boundaries of the biblical canon. So already right off the bat, you know, we implicitly, you know, recognize that the church fathers contribute so much to our faith. And if they were right about these things, maybe they have something to say as well on the issue of education. And of course, they're writing in a very different context. We have to acknowledge that up front. And yet, in a lot of ways, and I make this point in the book, that in some ways, they were dealing with a context that's more similar to our own today than most of the period we'd call Christendom. The church fathers, especially the ones I'm looking at in this book, were writing in a time where Christianity was not a privileged relationship in all of society. It was also a time of plague. It was a time of great migrations of people, conflict, war. And they're writing in a time where they're recognizing all of these factors and trying to think about, how do we educate souls? How do we train students in faith and virtue in the midst of all of these challenges that the world is throwing at us? So I think if you go back and read the fathers, in a lot of ways, the concerns that they're bringing to the forefront, the issues they have going on in the backs of their minds, are surprisingly similar to a lot of things that we're experiencing today. But in terms of why they're important for us, I really like a quote that you gave in your book on Christian teaching. You said that the cultivation of a Christian imagination, one rooted in both scriptures and a communion of saints that stretches beyond the bounds of our own social and historical context, can help us to see our tasks and contexts anew. They can help us to imagine differently. And David, I think you're right on with that idea that, if nothing else, a visit with the fathers, a chance to engage their writings and think about their ideas, they're going to help us imagine things differently. They're going to help us bring different kinds of questions to the table and perhaps think about different kind of solutions that then we would naturally be drawn to or come up with on our own. So I think that idea of using the church fathers as an opportunity to help us expand our imagination, expand our vocabulary, I think is the way that I would take that.
I love that thought, because I find the same with, you know, the time I spend with Comenius, who's my sort of main historical conversation partner, that I feel like when I first started reading historical Christian figures after I became a Christian, like the first impulse was to kind of go looking for people in history who agreed with me, right? And you kind of, you know, you bolster your own theology by finding that, you know, Augustine said it too, right? So it's kind of, so it must be right, because, they're on my side. And I feel like as time's gone on, I've gotten more and more interested in trying to figure out how are they actually different from me, and what did they see that I've not managed to see, and can that help me? So I really resonate with what you were saying there about that sort of sense of distance. Say a little more about, what's your sense of, because you've spent a long time training to do this, how should we go about reading people who were writing a couple of thousand years ago? Because, you know, that it is a different time, a different thought style, a different writing style, a different historical context. And so there's always kind of struggle between, on the one hand, they're like us, and yet they're not like us. What have you learned about how to fruitfully read these texts and, like, bring your own questions, but not have your own questions overwhelm the text? That's what I always wrestle with when I'm reading these kinds of figures.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's not too different from what your pastor might do in preaching, right? So taking a biblical text, maybe Paul is addressing the church in Corinth. He's talking about a particular issue in the church of Corinth that isn't an issue for us today, right? Most of us aren't concerned about the issue of meat sacrifice to idols, for instance, that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians. And yet, any preacher worth his salt will be able to draw contemporary applications to our present day. And so I think if you approach the fathers from that same kind of homiletical point of view, where we think about what are the concrete applications that we can take away as we bridge the gap between the past and the present. So an example that I would give, for instance, is I have a chapter on John Chrysostom and his view of how we engage a student's various senses for the sake of learning. And the examples that he gives as he walks through each of the senses are quite different from today. So for instance, he talks about needing to, for a teacher and a parent to guard a student's eyes. And so he's very concerned, for instance, that a student might be led to a mixed gender bath, right? Or to the theater, which in ancient times, there was often quite a bit of immorality on the stage of the theater. And so when we think about the question of guarding our students' eyes today, I don't think any of us are worried about ancient theatrical performances. I don't think we're worried about any of our students going to a mixed gender hot springs bath kind of deal. I'm not aware of any of those around me. But that principle of needing to guard our students' eyes, is that something that we can apply in our context? And I think, yes, absolutely. And I think your book on digital life together, I mean, I think gets at a lot of those same conversations. So it's taking the fundamental principle, in this case, the need to guard our students' eyes, and just think about how would that apply in our setting, in our context versus in his.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us any other examples of, like, you know, specific things you've learned from the, because we've talked in very general terms about the church fathers and so on. What are the lessons you're drawing from them in the book in relation to teaching?
Yeah. The example I gave before was about students, but maybe it's worth talking about teachers for a minute. I think it's interesting. A lot of books on Christian education have very little to say about the formation of the teacher himself or herself. That seems to be assumed. But I think if we're going to be really investing in forming in the souls of our students, actually we have to start with how are we forming our own souls as educators? And so I start the book there, actually. And in that chapter, I look at Gregory the Great and some of his writings on spiritual direction. And I think in that case, a lot of the examples he gives are very directly relevant to our time period. He talks a lot about the need, for instance, for times of contemplation, for times of silence, for times of solitude and self-examination. And of course, we live in a time where we're so busy, we're so focused on getting things done. And especially as teachers, as educators, you know, we're rushing across campus, trying to finish this lesson plan, trying to pick up this book from the library, off to this meeting that may or may not be worth our time, right? Trying to figure out the new technology for this, that, or the other. And it's, you know, rush, 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 rush. And I think especially for people like us who are in the field of education, tasked with this work of forming students' souls, we have to find ways to cultivate space ourselves to be prayerful, to be mindful, to reflect on what's going on under the surface of our own lives. And so likewise, I draw some applications there. I talk about the practice of the prayer of examine from St. Ignatius Loyola, some other strategies that Christians have used through the centuries to think about what would it mean for me as a Christian educator to slow down, to tend to my own soul so that I'd be able to, from the overflow of my own soul, my own relationship with God, be able to give of that to my students rather than running on empty, running on dry.
It makes me think of a poignant conversation I had some years ago with I was on a curriculum committee at a Christian group of Christian schools, and one of the school leaders suddenly said in the middle of one of the meetings, like, everybody thinks I'm responsible for my students' faith formation, and who's forming my faith? Because my church isn't. Mm-hmm. So how do I become the kind of person who can do this? I totally agree that that's a really important area of focus. Have you shared this with your colleagues in your own school and beyond?
Yeah.
I'm just curious what, because sometimes when I talk to people about slowing down, the first response is, you don't understand, we had four people retire and everybody's doing a job and a half. This is beautiful idea. But what kind of responses are you getting to the invitation to take time with the church fathers?
Yeah. So actually, interestingly, I've written a few books, but this was the first book that I've written that was written in a really collaborative manner. So over the course of a school year, I had a group of about 10 or 12 educators from my school who gave up time early on Friday morning to come in and read through portions of the manuscript as I was drafting it. they were able to provide a lot of the specific examples, classroom examples that made their way into the book. And it was such a rich and fruitful time for me as a writer, just having that input over the course of drafting the book. And it was super interesting seeing people's reactions and responses along the way. And, you know, for a lot of my friends that were part of the reading group, they had no exposure to the church fathers. Like, maybe they'd heard of St. Augustine at some point in their life, but they couldn't tell you anything else about the early church. So that was a good challenge for me as a writer, to think about, how do I write this kind of book in such a way that it'll be accessible to your average Christian educator who probably doesn't have a whole lot of grounding in this particular aspect of church history. But then, yeah, those conversations of engaging people about, okay, so if we recognize that it's important, for example, for us to slow down as educators to find time, what could that look like? What does that look like for you in your career? What are some ways you've seen people do that well? And being able to have those conversations collectively, I think really improved the book, because, again, a lot of those examples made it into the book. And so what I would love is, as people are reading this book, I would love for people to read it collaboratively as well. And so if perhaps there's a department or a division of a school that would be interested in reading it together, I think the most fruitful conversations would come from asking precisely those questions of one another. So, okay, we all agree that we need to find time and space to invest in our own spiritual lives, even in the midst of our work days, because we can't separate our spiritual lives from our vocation, from our work. What would it look like for us to do that? And maybe then that's a conversation that needs to bring in administration and talk to administrators and say, okay, if this is the work that you're calling us to do, how could you help support us in this important part of our work? And I think that those kind of conversations would be really helpful for an institution to have.
I think a lot of us who write about education, you know, when you write, you're hoping to make something better for teachers or for students or for parents or for some aspect of education. Do you have a, I think we've heard some of it tumbling around in what you've been saying, but do you have like a, can you articulate a core vision for what you want to change as a result of this book existing? Mm-hmm. How is this going to help? What's it going to do for us?
Yeah, I think the core idea of the book is nothing shocking. In a lot of ways, it's very similar to stuff that you've written, I think of On Christian Teaching in particular. It's just providing more of a historical grounding for it. But I think the idea that it's pushing on is this idea that everything we do is formative. As teachers, how we spend our time, how we view our students, then what it is that we're teaching, our curriculum, and then what are we doing in our classroom? How do we teach? How do we engage with time? How do we use space in our classroom? How do we design plans over the long term that will move students down the road in terms of hopefully growing in faith and virtue? And really recognizing that every choice we're making is contributing either positively or negatively towards our students' view of the good life, towards their own personal telos. Yeah, so I think that's a theme that you've certainly touched on quite a bit in your work. Yeah, I don't know your impression reading my work, but I definitely felt like there was a David Smith in the back of my head chattering away as I wrote.
Well, I'm probably going to have Kyle Hughes in the back of my head now going forward. I mean, I'm left with a couple of thoughts here. One is that you know, the formational side of educational work is deeply important and also very difficult. And that we really ought to be drawing on all of the resources we can from the history of the church and not acting as if we started talking about this 3 years ago and we're really just left to our own devices. And I think you've really helped us with that in providing an accessible way in. And I also just want to name that something like this takes a lot of time, not just the time you've spent in the last few years writing the book, but the years before that you've invested in gaining the expertise that allows you to tackle a project like this. So I'm grateful for that time that you've invested in bringing this part of church history into connection with our current Christian education discussions. And I really hope that people will honor that and take it up and see what they can learn from it. So thank you for all the work on it. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
So if you want to get hold of the book, just go to your favorite bookseller and look for Teaching for Spiritual Formation. Searching for that should get you the book, but the subtitle is A Patristic Approach to Christian Education in a Convulsed Age by Kyle Hughes. It's a brand new book, came out in January this year, and I recommend it to you as a way to think about how to be formed in your own faith in relation to teaching and how to help your students' formation. I'm David Smith, and you're listening to the Faith in Teaching podcast from the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Calvin University. In this series, we'll be talking with researchers and educators who are working to understand how Christian faith affects teaching, learning, and the way we do education.